From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Hurricane Florence is taking her time. She's now expected to hover off of North Carolina tomorrow, probably make landfall early Saturday, then turn left and pummel South Carolina and now Georgia. Here's FEMA's Jeff Byard.
This is not going to be a glancing blow. This is not going to be a tropical storm. This is not going to be, one of those storms that hit and move out to sea. This is going to be, a Mike Tyson punch to the Carolina coast, and then it's going to have very heavy rains.
And as Florence shifts a little to the south, North Carolina won't be spared. We mentioned she's going to hover there, which means she's going to suck up water. The governor there is warning residents, everyone, not just coastal residents, to prepare. We'll keep you updated.
And we're also going to follow President Trump's reaction to this storm yesterday. He said the federal response to Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico last year was an incredible unsung success, even though nearly 3,000 people died in that storm. Let's bring in our political strategist. Alice Stewart is a Republican. Alice, it's good to have you back.
Great to be with you, Peter and Robin.
And Bill Press, it's good to have you, a Democratic strategist. You've got a new book out this week. It's called Trump Must Go, the top 100 reasons to dump Trump and one to keep him. That's a catchy title, Bill. Welcome.
A very subtle title. Hi, it's great
exactly.
to be here.
Are you the
I'm
Democrat?
Yeah. Right.
Alice, tell us what you really think.
We'll try to get to that one reason.
Right.
Alice, let's start with President Trump, who made this speech in Pennsylvania yesterday marking 9/11 that David Gergen is calling one of the best of his presidency. And then hours later, he makes these comments about the unsung success of his response to Hurricane Maria. I mean, what do you think? It seems like he has this tendency of wiping out these positive moments with yet another controversy.
Sure. We can all look back at the lessons learned from that storm, Hurricane Maria, and look at things that could have been done much, much better. And to say that it was a success, in my view, is way off the mark. I do know that the federal government did everything that they possibly could, pulled out all the resources. But at the end of the day, when you have over 3,000 lives lost, there's not a whole lot to look back on that is positive. And in my view, it takes a lot more than throwing paper towels at the problem to try and really show a strong response. The most important thing that we can take from that is learn from things that may not have gone right and make sure we do them right this time around.
Well, Bill, this is a softball for you, obviously, because FEMA's own report from July acknowledged empty warehouses in Puerto Rico, unqualified staff, no truck drivers, the wrong type of satellite phones. And then you had the pictures of the president, throwing paper towels at people, which is what he did when he got there. But he made very strong statements and is making very strong statements today about people need to get prepared on the coast. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, in a sense, the president is his own worst enemy. I mean, look, we have to say, I believe, that FEMA did a great job with Maria in Texas and in Florida, but they dropped the ball in Puerto Rico. I don't think there's any other way to see it. You ask the people of Puerto Rico, as you mentioned, 3,000 deaths. We learned from BuzzFeed today that over 2,300 people have applied to FEMA for funeral assistance. That's part of the program that they provide for victims there. And only 75 have been approved so far by FEMA. So I think for the president to get up, as the American people want to hear, and certainly the people of North Carolina and South Carolina, that help is on the way, FEMA's there, we're really ready, that's a good message. But then he has to jump all over that message by reigniting the feud with Puerto Rico, which I think is really pointless. I just remember while President Trump was saying, it's inaccessible because it's an island surrounded by water, big water. Chef Jose Andres was on the site and had fed thousands and thousands and thousands of people.
Alice, related.
He got there.
Right, yeah. Alice, related to this news, we got an interesting tidbit from Oregon Democrat Senator Jeff Merkley last night that $10 million of FEMA money was transferred to ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, for what officials are calling higher priority detention and removal of undocumented immigrants. And we heard from FEMA's Brock Long today on ABC's Good Morning America about this.
It's just an attempt to divert away from the life safety issues at Florence. It does not come out of the disaster relief fund that funds everything behind me, that funds everything in the field. So it's a non-issue for us at this moment.
Alice, a non-issue? I mean, at least you could say the optics aren't great.
The optics are not great, and you can spin it to where it does sound as diverting attention away from the real threat. But I have every confidence in the world in Brock Long and the work that he does and how he is taking control of the situation. And it's important to note that these monies are in different pools and different pots. And if someone wants to spin it and look as though we're taking the eye off the ball in certainly, as Hurricane Florence builds up steam, that's completely wrong. And I have the confidence in Brock Long and what they're doing, and what they've, as I said, what they learned in Puerto Rico and how they're preparing for Hurricane Florence.
Well, but to say that, you know, there's a higher priority of detention and removal of undocumented immigrants, as we're hearing, you know, from Bill, you just mentioned, we haven't even buried people or helped people bury people in Puerto Rico, and now the storm is coming. So, Bill, I want to ask you, how does this dovetail with politics? The most important thing right now is lives on the East Coast. But we know when presidents make missteps in big storms, you know, good job, Brownie. We know what can happen. And we have these polls coming out this week showing that President Trump's approval ratings dropping below 40% over the past month. That's considered real bad when you're approaching a midterm. You know, again, you don't want to look at this through the political prism, but this administration has got to handle this storm well.
They do have to handle this storm well, and the timing of this FEMA moving of $10 million to ICE could not be worse for the administration. I think you have to ask why also they did it. I think they did it because if they went to Congress and asked $10 million to lock up more little kids in cages for ICE to do that, Congress would say, no way, we're not going to fund that. It's the only way they could get it. They basically stole it from FEMA. And however you spin it, the way I see it, it's $10 million that FEMA will not have to use for any aspect of hurricane relief, which is the number one priority right now. Mm-hmm. Again, I think this administration sometimes doesn't get the credit it deserves, I guess, because it steps all over what the good things that it's doing.
Okay, let's talk about the midterms. And you never know. I mean, as Robin just hinted at, the response to this hurricane may affect what happens in the midterms. But Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said something very interesting yesterday. He said it's going to be challenging for Republicans running for seats in 9 states.
Arizona, Nevada, Tennessee, Montana, North Dakota, Missouri, Indiana, West Virginia, and Florida. All of them too close to call, and every one of them like a knife fight in an alley. I mean, just a brawl. I hope when the smoke clears that we'll still have a majority in the Senate.
Alice, that is a huge shift. I mean, is he just trying to get people to go out to vote, or is he right?
Peter, I was wanting to scream at him, stop! They're running out of states there. But look, I think the reality is, you know, history has proven that midterm elections are generally not favorable and not successful for the party in power in the first term of an administration, and this is nothing new. And the poll numbers you just stressed with regard to the president's approval numbers at a historic low is also not helpful. But I think it's wise for Speaker McConnell and others to be brutally honest with the voters, specifically Republicans, but also appealing to independents, that we need to encourage voters to come out and vote. Enthusiasm is key in midterm elections, and I would much rather have a hard dose of brutal honesty than sugarcoat things and have people sit at home. So it's important to speak the truth.
I just got
to
jump
Republican voters.
Just got to jump in for a second, Bill. Just hold on 1 second, because I have to ask Alice. Apparently, Alice, you just got off the phone with the White House, because there's news coming out today about the upcoming midterms. The president signed an executive order to sanction foreign entities or individuals who meddle in U.S. elections. What's going on here? He's been denying that there's meddling. He hasn't backed the Congress. You know, Congress has bills to look at meddling, hasn't pushed that. Why suddenly, dovetailing perhaps with these polls coming out, why is the president suddenly up in arms about meddling?
It's important. Look, no one can deny that election meddling is a problem.
Well, and he did.
Donald Trump.
With regard to Russia specifically. But what this does, this is a clear sign that the White House and this administration, specifically the president, is doing everything he can to ensure the preventing election meddling in the future. And this is a good sign. If we had gone about through the legislative process, it may have taken much too long. But this was a quick way to show that, all right, the buck stops here, and we're not going to sit back and let election meddling happen yet again.
Bill, yeah, go ahead. Your thoughts.
No, I just got to say, I think this is a proverbial case of too little, too late. I mean, our intelligence agencies said a year and a half ago that Russia had interfered in our election. Donald Trump, even by signing this executive order, has yet to acknowledge and admit that Russia did interfere in the 2016 election for the purpose, it turns out, of helping him get elected. So there is the Rubio Van Hollen legislation, I think, which is more important. Just very, very quickly, on the midterms, I think Mitch McConnell is telling the truth. It is stunning to see how the political landscape has shifted and Democrats have a chance of taking this.
Even quicker, Bill Press, again, the Democratic strategist. The one reason to keep Donald Trump, real quick.
One reason to keep him is Mike Pence would be a lot worse in my estimation.
Okay, he is the Democratic strategist, Bill Press.
We got it in.
Alice. Jobs numbers are good. The economy's great.
Okay, guys.
And that's Alice Stewart. She's the Republican. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we're going to turn now to a topic that probably won't be appropriate for all, because we're going to talk about sex. And we don't want to attach any shame to the subject, because there's more than enough of that already. Now, many women of a certain age grew up in the 50s, maybe, hearing girls who had any kind of sex before marriage were bad girls. But for many evangelical women, it's worse than bad. It's damning for them and the men and boys they've led astray. This thinking is part of a purity movement that grew in the 1980s and 90s with books against dating, pledges, rings, and the warning that every sexual thought and activity, alone or with others, will make you impure and unwanted. Linda K. Klein grew up in that culture as a devout evangelical. She prayed, led study groups, went to Bible camp. By the time she was a teenager, she was so traumatized by the purity message that she nearly died before seeking treatment for her Crohn's disease because she wanted to prove that she was a girl of spirit, not flesh. Eventually, she questioned the message, spoke to other women. Her new book is Pure, Inside the Evangelical Movement That Shamed a Generation of Young Women and How I Broke Free. She joins us from New York. Welcome.
Thank you.
And let's just set some ground rules here when we talk about the evangelical movement. This is the single largest religious group in the U.S. You're writing about the white conservative subculture you grew up in. And tell us more about this purity industry with groups like the Silver Ring thing. What is it?
So the purity movement, which is what these organizations were a part of, very quickly turned into a purity industry, which these organizations were also a part of. So that's when you started to see things like purity rings and purity pledges and purity curricula, even purity-themed Bibles. So try not to associate your sexuality and your salvation when a sixth of your Bible is about the importance of purity.
This is amazing. You write about this Bible from the Silver Ring Thing group. In and among the real Bible verses is this instruction, keep your clothes on, zipped and buttoned. And what are girls in particular told?
The message that girls get, that if you are impure or deemed impure by the community, because ultimately it's the community that decides whether you're pure or impure, that there's really no place for you in the community.
And again, you rush to write that there are many women and men that you've heard from who embrace this. But you met people that had such trauma because it was being told that you were loved unconditionally. That's how Jesus loves. Except you were hellbound if, you know, you had one little flaw that made you impure. So it wasn't. It was conditional love.
Yeah, whether or not you were hellbound from a spiritual perspective was debatable. Most people would say you could still go to heaven even if you were impure, but that might be after experiencing hell here on earth because there's no place for you within this community if you're impure.
Well, you talk about kissing a young man and being so traumatized by that you broke up with him for fear that that would ruin you for life.
Yeah, shame. When I say shame, I'm not talking about bashfulness. I'm not talking about shyness. I'm talking about feelings of worthlessness. So feeling that you are fundamentally and in your totality bad because of how people perceive your sexual purity is no small thing. Shame can make people feel desperate, feel hopeless. It can lead to suicidal tendencies. And certainly one thing that I saw in many of my interviewees is, and that I've experienced myself, is that the extreme shame and fear and anxiety for many people started to manifest in ways that mimicked classic PTSD.
Now, again, this is sensitive material and it's not for all ears. But one of the women that you met, this purity thinking was so pervasive in her home that when she was raped by her own brother, the parents blamed her?
Because she had not fought back, they said that they would never know who was really to blame. And so ultimately, they blamed the two of them. You know, the ethic is one man and one woman in marriage forever. You know, there's no mention in there about violence. There's no mention in there about abuse. So when violence and abuse does happen, it still is subconsciously assessed by that same sexual ethic. Did it happen between one man and one woman in marriage forever? Yes. Okay. Then it couldn't possibly have been rape, even if, you know, somebody describes a deeply violent experience. Did it happen outside of one woman, one man in marriage forever? Yes, then both parties are impure and both parties are, you know, in some way at fault. And particularly women and girls who within purity culture are taught that it's their job to maintain the sexual purity of everyone because they hold the threat. So when women and girls are violated, oftentimes we go back and we say, okay, what did she do wrong?
It's not just in the evangelical faiths. It is in other faiths, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. You write about Elizabeth Smart, who was had been kidnapped. And she said in speaking at Johns Hopkins University in a trafficking and sexual violence conference, after the first rape, I was crushed because who would want me now? She was taught something having to do with a stick of gum.
Yeah, one of the most overt ways that the purity message is taught is via object lessons, and many object lessons are about food. So you're shown a stick of gum, and this stick of gum represents the sexually untouched woman or girl. And then you chew that stick of gum. It's forever changed. And then you invite others. Who wants to stick this stick of gum in your mouth now? It's already been in someone else's mouth. It's full of saliva. Nobody wants to have that stick of gum anymore. And just imagine how that would feel to somebody who's in the room who has already had any sexual experience, because in the purity movement, it's not just sex that makes you impure. It could potentially be sexual thoughts, sexual feelings, other people's sexual thoughts or feelings or behaviors toward you that you're said to elicit.
There's a lot of cultural references. One woman says to you, you know how the Dementors in the Harry Potter books, the Dementor characters, they bring out horrible memories. The Dementors to her became like the church. So, you know, people are driven away from the church because it brings back all these horrible memories of how they were shamed.
One thing that really surprised me was how many people told me that they would walk into a church and they would break down into tears. It had become precisely such a dementor, as you were talking about now, a reminder of that shame, the place where the trauma of repetitive shaming year after year happened to them.
Well, and when they go to get help, many therapists have not heard of this, so don't know about what's being called post-traumatic pastor disorder. But it sounds like we're already seeing shifts because Josh Harris, the young man who wrote that I Kissed Dating Goodbye book that became this, you know, shaming manual for so many young women, ultimately ended up, first of all, admitting that he'd been abused as a child. Maybe that's where some of this came from. And he ended up online talking to people on Twitter about, you know, apologizing for what he had done.
Yeah, it's been an incredible journey to watch him wrestle with his role within the purity movement. And I think he's still wrestling to this day. It's interesting because he really has come out and owned that his telling people that they shouldn't date, he was very instrumental in a lot of people's lives within the purity movement in making people think that actually even dating was a road to impurity. And hopefully he'll continue to wrestle and continue to deconstruct some of the ideas that he put out there.
Well, some of the Twitter handles that have popped up in these conversations that he's sometimes having with young women who are online saying, this is what this book did to me. Hashtag kiss shame by. Hashtag life after IKDG.
I Kissed Dating Goodbye. Yeah, that was his biggest seller.
So there's been this pushback. There's also movements, anti-purity movements, if you will. Tell us about one.
Sure. I really love the No Shame movement. And this is a website, first and foremost, that is a place for people to go to share their stories of having grown up within the purity movement and how it's impacted their lives. And it also aggregates a lot of the stories that are out there already in the media. There is something bigger happening right now. And I think the core of it is around people rising up and beginning to tell their stories and beginning to come into voice. We are told that if our experience experience isn't blissful and perfect, that it's because of our sin or because of our psychosis, because we are doing something wrong, more and more people are coming to the realization that, no, something wrong was done to me, and we can stand up together and create change.
Well, you know, you talked about how great it was for you over 12 years to talk to all these other women who tell incredible stories, and they're in the book. But going to write the book was a different thing. You went home, and your mother tried to make the case with you that your telling the story was akin to, I think, mass slaughter. Because if people misconstrue what you say and get bad feelings about God, that isn't good for your salvation. And you might have been operating as an arm of Satan. He's the prince of lies, your mom says. I don't want him using you.
Yeah, there are high stakes for questioning this message, or really questioning any core central messages to evangelicalism. You know, for my mom, the fear that she had that I would lose my salvation really came out of a deep, deep place of love. You know, my mom, the thing that she cares about most in the world is that when she dies and goes to heaven, that I am right there next to her. And she's coming to a much greater peace around it.
What are you hearing from people who feel wrongly characterized?
What I'm hoping is that the evangelicals who are on the ground, the people in the pews, I'm talking about the youth pastors who are working with the kids. I'm talking about the chaplains who are working with the college students. You know, these people, when I talk to them, know that this is happening. They see the shame. They feel the shame. And what I'm really hoping is that those people on the ground will be able to be heard by the celebrities of evangelicalism. If the groundswell were to come forward and start to say, here's my experience, you know, I think we could see a tremendous amount of change.
Well, we'll see. Linda K. Klein, again, the book is Pure, Inside the Evangelical Movement That Shamed a Generation of Young Women and How I Broke Free. Linda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
As part of preparations for Hurricane Florence, now expected to arrive on Saturday, the Navy has sent dozens of ships out to sea from its base in Norfolk, Virginia. Rear Admiral John Meyer is aboard the USS George Herbert Walker Bush. Admiral Meyer, where are you?
We're currently with our 25 ships off the coast of Florida. So we have sortied 2 days ago and transited south. We're staying well out in front of the storm and the sea state that the storm is producing to take all of our ships to a safe location, and then we'll turn around and come in behind the storm and return back to Norfolk.
Well, you've sortied, you've deployed. We understand you got the orders for sortie condition alpha to get ready to do this. And I guess it makes sense that boats are better off bobbing in the water than, you know, lashed to a dock and maybe bashing up against the dock.
Yeah, that's exactly the reason. And if you leave ships in port, there's always the hazard, if you will, that a ship can be damaged, broken loose from its mooring lines, or that our piers and infrastructure can be damaged as well. So it's much, much better to get us to sea. And we've sent almost all of the ships out of the Norfolk Naval Base to sea.
Well, so you're out down by Florida. Look, here on the mainland, we're hearing that this is a monster storm coming in. I mean, maybe a once in a lifetime. What are you seeing out in the water?
Well, where we're at right now, we're seeing beautiful weather, no rain, relatively calm seas down in the Strait of Florida right now. But I am certainly concerned about the storm itself. Florence has the potential to be a absolutely devastating storm. I have friends and family that are in the area of North Carolina, and as do many of our sailors, and really concerned for our nation as this devastating storm bears down on the East Coast.
Well, I was thinking about that because you've got 25 boats filled with crew that left family behind.
That's true. And my family in particular got evacuated from a coastal region of Virginia. Yeah. That's part of the I guess I would offer the Navy way of life, is that we train our families. We do a lot of hurricane preparations with groups that we call a family readiness group, and we practice these sort of things. And most families that have gone through that actually have bags packed and ready during hurricane season where we live.
Well, Admiral Meyer, I just, it strikes us that this must be hard for you because you're in the Navy to serve and protect. And in this case, you have to go in the opposite direction.
Well, I don't know that I would say that it's hard for me. I think I've been at this now for a little over 32 years. My wife and I have been married for 25 years. This is not the first time I've left my family due to a hurricane. My family met me in a Liberty port in Guam years ago. A typhoon came in, and I and the rest of the sailors that were on board the USS Kitty Hawk at the time, we got back on board the Kitty Hawk and left our families in Guam, and they weathered out the storm. There is an aspect of that that can be a little bit unnerving, but the aspect of preparing the sailors to go to sea and preparing their families, all the groundwork that we've done ahead of time for this, I think has put us in a good position. And the responsibility of making sure that we take care of all these ships and the aircraft that we have on board is also a pretty significant responsibility as well.
Rear Admiral John Meyer, commander of Carrier Strike Group 10, speaking to us from the USS George Herbert Walker Bush out in the Atlantic in the Florida Straits, waiting out Florence. Admiral Meyer, thank you.
You're welcome. Very nice talking to you today, Robin.
School is back in session, and students everywhere are busy carrying on the time-honored tradition of complaining about their homework and watching the clock for recess. But actually, a lot has changed for kids in American schools through history. Let's take a look with Nathan Connolly. Hi, Nathan.
Hello, hello.
And Ed Ayers. Ed, it's good to speak with you again.
Thanks, Peter. Me too.
Ed and Nathan are historians and hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. And guys, in Boston, we have some very old schools. Boston Latin claims to be America's oldest public school, established in 1635, 15 years after the Mayflower landed. What were those early schools like in America, and what did they teach?
So education in the early period was really about advancing social order, and schools were the building blocks of social order in a lot of ways. In Massachusetts, in fact, you have a law that's developed in 1642 that is very clear about using schools to basically end or stave off barbarism, to use that language of the day. And it's wonderful to imagine that, you know, the kind of concerns about neighbors hurting each other or people stealing from each other was going to be addressed through moral education in schools. And the law itself basically said good education is about families learning to treat each other basically well.
These were Puritans.
That's right. That's right. And so as with any, you know, of the colonies in the early period, obviously concerns about moral turpitude and religion are going to be woven into everyday education.
Today, it seems like when we talk about education, it's very much about getting ready for jobs, getting ready to go to college, in some cases even finding your passion. But it sounds like you're saying that back then, education was more something to stabilize society and maybe even democracy.
Yeah, the United States is this weird idea that you're going to be able to really create a country without anything to hold it together except people's own good intentions and good character. And the schools are, along with the family, the only things that can inculcate that. So from the very beginning, the United States has put an undue weight, really, on what schools are expected to do. And when you have all the ethnic diversity, and Nathan was saying that these are always the fault lines about the differences in society, people think, well, maybe the schools would be the ways to create some kind of commonality among us.
How long was the school year back then?
There was a school only a few months. And so it's ironic to think now about back to school coming every year, the same time, August, September.
Yeah.
But in the early part of the country's history, there really wasn't anything like back to school. It wasn't a cultural happening in the way we think about it. The idea, of course, was that you had to set aside time for education, but a child's life or the life of a young adult was going to be full of any number of responsibilities, including labor and harvesting and taking care of other kids in the family. So the notion that you could have a full school day 9 months out of the year was absolutely not a possibility for most families who relied on everyone pitching in.
Yeah, you had a lot of work to do. Look, when did we get to this concept that a free public education is a right? It's not in the Constitution.
It's certainly not. And the idea that it's a right has been highly unstable. It's a local right. I think, that people look at this and you know, you're referring to Massachusetts early on, sort of a different culture than you might have found in Virginia, the other oldest colony, where the idea was, hey, you know, it's your kid. You take care of educating them. Mm-hmm. And so that's not written in the Constitution. As a matter of fact, that's very unusual. Most of the constitutions of the countries and around the world do have education written in as a right. But because the United States has these different levels of government of local and state and federal, this was seen as a local and state responsibility.
Okay. 19th century, there is a very famous man in education with the name of Horace Mann. Tell us about him and his role in the schools that we see today.
Sure. So Horace Mann, who lived in the antebellum period in Massachusetts, I mean, he was
an extraordinarily important... I'm sensing a theme here with Massachusetts, by the way.
He was the secretary of Massachusetts Board of Education, obviously a really prominent and important position. And his idea of education was in part about creating free, universal, non-sectarian schooling. So schools that were formerly, again, kind of inconsistent, built largely on a religious curriculum, were going to be revised in a way to generate broad, universal uplift for the country. Young people. He helped develop normal schools to professionalize teaching so that, again, students from school to school would get some kind of universal experience and that the curriculum itself would be based on a kind of general or, you know, again, non-sectarian Protestantism was part of the deal, right? The idea is that there are certain values, but we're not going to, say, get caught into any doctrinal debates necessarily in school. The one thing I will say about that, though, is that Catholics had took some issue with the idea that the Protestant template would be the only template in terms of how education could function.
I did some searching around on Horace Mann, you know, because I you notice that a lot of schools are named after him if you just sort of, you know, go about the world. More than 50 schools at least I could find that were named after Horace Mann. And I understand that because of him, that's when, like, there was a boom in the amount of school kids that were in the classroom in this country. Is that right?
If you were going to find a creator of the idea of everybody goes to school with a kind of a common basis, Horace Mann, well, he's the man. Catherine Beecher is the woman who has the same idea, noticing at the same time that a lot more teachers are becoming female. At the beginning, men would have been. And she says, well, you know, women are better teachers because they're nurturers. And so she was looking for a school for everyone as well. So it's sort of a tag team of Mann and Beecher who helped bring that about.
Right. I mean, yeah, the country in the 1850s, 1860s is doing a pretty good job. I mean, the United States has more school-age kids than any other country in the so-called developed world. What a kid basically means is actually anybody between the ages of 3 and 20 because the schools were extraordinarily broad in the kinds of folks that they accepted. And sometimes you'd have as many as 100 folks in a single one-room school. But I think the point, too, needs to be raised that even as you have these philosophical commitments to universal education, in places like the South, where there's a very different kind of educational culture relative to, say, planters dominating the educational conversation, it becomes very difficult. And it really isn't until you get to the late 19th century and you have many African Americans recently emancipated from slavery that you begin to see the kinds of universal, broad, state-funded education in the South that was advocated for, say, under Horace Mann in the North.
Right.
And so the beginning of public education, in fact, for everybody in the South, starts with Reconstruction because many even of the, among the planters thought, well, even white education or education for poor people should be done on a philanthropic basis. And so it's with the arrival of the Reconstruction Project that many African Americans basically begin to build public education in the South for everybody.
And of course, we'd have to wait even longer until 1954 with Brown versus Board of Education for desegregation in schools, Ed.
Yeah, and you know, African Americans have been fighting for a long time for anything like equality in education. Mm-hmm. And so even the length of the school year, black kids were not given as long a school year as white kids because they needed to be in the fields for harvest, white people determine. And so ironically, the remarkable effort for generation after generation for African Americans to create, sustain their own schools, it created sort of a black intelligentsia. The teachers in the community were among the most respected people there were. But there was still a clear sense that because support for education is so local, that localities and states in the South were starving the schools. And so the fight for desegregation was also a fight for equality. The same kind of struggle had been going on across American history.
I want to throw you a wild card. There's a lot of kids who are just getting going with the school year. Where did this idea that you need to bring an apple to your teacher come from?
Well, it's actually very interesting.
Because you know the answer.
I do know the answer, and I was just hoping you'd ask me. This is equivalent
to. He's a pro. He's a pro.
Well, this is where the phrase apple polisher comes from. How about that? So, like a bonus answer, the answer to your question is that Nathan was talking about when school begins. It's in the fall. Mm-hmm. This is when apples are coming in. But it was begun in the early 20th century when the idea of an apple as a substitute for cider, that apples just to eat them were good. Uh-huh. And this is the same time an apple a day keeps a doctor away was invented. So it's all a part of a gigantic marketing campaign by the advocates of apples. And look how great it is to get all this free advertising right now.
Why does that not surprise me?
Whoa, that's awesome.
Ed Ayers and Nathan Connolly, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Ed, you're the apple of my eye. That's all I can say. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And a story now about autism and the kinds of misunderstandings that can occur when people encounter behavior they don't understand. Children with autism often have difficulty with social interaction because of neurological differences. But what happens in the classroom where everyone is on the lookout for behavior that might warn of potential violence? Connecticut Public Radio's David DeRoche has the story of a high school student who was singled out by classmates who worried that his autism made him violent.
Someone's here. They landed above me.
Owen Lynch likes to keep to himself, even when he's playing a video game online against 100 other people. His survival strategy is to avoid the other players.
Yeah. There's a theme.
Owen, who's 17, has autism. For him, that can make it hard to socialize. And he says for as long as he can remember, that's made him a target for bullies.
I was bullied during middle school. Going home, they used to throw rocks at me and bully me till a certain point. And I'd have to actually get brought home by some of my friends because if I walked alone, I'd just get, you know, picked on.
Owen's supposed to be in school, but instead he's at home on his Xbox. Soon after the shootings in Parkland, Florida, some of his classmates targeted him on social media, saying that he'd be the next school shooter.
I haven't really been getting a lot of sleep lately. I've been kind of stressed out during the night, having panic attacks.
One day at the high school he attended in Norwalk, Connecticut, a classmate called police and told them a student might have a gun in the building. The officers pulled several students from class for questioning. When they came to Owen's room, he noticed his classmates staring at him.
And I was like, oh, they're here for me. This is not going to be nice. And at that moment, I knew that at least half the school was going to say something about me.
He was right. Police concluded it was a false alarm, but other students quickly took to social media. One student shared a photo of Owen's face stuck on a stick figure holding a gun, and others wrote about him with the hashtag #SchoolShooter. So Owen hasn't stepped foot in the school since. His mom, Heather Florian, says his decision to stay home has deep roots.
Owen doesn't feel safe going back there. This isn't a singular incident of bullying. This is a long history of bullying, Owen.
When Owen was 10, a psychologist diagnosed him with autism spectrum disorder. Years went by, and he wasn't getting any special education services. Meanwhile, records indicate the bullying continued. In middle school, it got so bad that Owen had to go to the hospital 3 times for depression and feeling suicidal.
During one of the hospitalizations in Yale, he was diagnosed with PTSD due to bullying.
Not long after that, he was suspended from middle school because, as some students claimed, Owen said he would blow up the school. Police got involved and he had to go to court, but the judge threw out the charges. He and his mom say it was a misunderstanding. We don't have access to those court records. Oftentimes, records for minors are expunged. And here's where things get complicated. Everyone who knows Owen agrees that he has emotional problems, but
there is no evidence base that suggests that individuals with autism are actually more at risk for becoming school shooters.
That's Hank Schwartz, a psychiatrist at the Institute of Living in Hartford, one of the oldest mental health hospitals in the country. He says students with autism often act and talk differently, and their peers can sometimes misinterpret those messages.
Because they act in a withdrawn way and at times may have some difficulty with their connectedness to others. Such individuals become the subject of bullying and of suspicion, and it's quite unfortunate.
Once Owen became known as the kid who threatened to blow up the school, his mom says it wasn't a big leap to call him the kid who would shoot up the school.
I just want what's best for Owen, and I'm tired of fighting for it on my own. It's a hard fight.
Owen doesn't have a history of violence, but he does have a history of being bullied, which records show hurt his mental health. Being bullied and having a mental illness are risk factors for becoming violent, experts say. And the school's role in prevention is key, according to Connecticut's investigation into Adam Lanza's murderous rampage at Sandy Hook Elementary back in 2012. Investigators found the school had consistently failed to educate Lanza and may have contributed to his mental decline. The Norwalk School District has a history of problems with its special ed department. Despite repeated attempts, school officials declined to comment on Owen's history in the bullying incident, citing student privacy concerns. And despite his record showing a history of bullying, a school investigation claimed this history didn't exist. But that same investigation included this advice for Owen. They wanted to help him, quote, ignore the bullying. Owen hasn't forgotten.
I'm so used to getting bullied and picked on, it makes me just shake, and I just don't know anymore. It hurts. I don't know. It's just hard.
Owen didn't attend school for the rest of the semester. He only got a few hours of tutoring each week. He and his family recently moved to another town about an hour away where he's attending school this year. His mom says Owen's situation is part of the reason for the move. For Here and Now, I'm David DeRoche.
Oh, I hope David checked back in with us. Let us know how Owen is doing. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.